In today's edition of COVID Race and Democracy,
people's health should not be politicized, and it is. We are in this for the long haul.
The COVID-19 pandemic may last 5 to 10 years, a nurse speaks out.
This company has for years allowed and engaged in exceptionally racist behavior, behavior that is beyond any concept of humanity.
Black workers face hanging nooses at the port of Long Beach, California.
Experiencing how the control of this radio microphone allowed me to play a role in changing the political complexion of a rather large black city, that did it for me. I said, well, this is worthwhile work.
Glenn Ford on giving grassroots leaders a voice.
All the basic principles of public health, isolation, tracing, testing, and support for those that can't work or who are sick should be part of the demands of the rank and file members who organize on the job.
Public health is a life and death question, says Navin Gordon. From Pacifica Radio, this is COVID Race and Democracy, a collective effort by producers within the Pacifica Network. I'm your host, Steve Zeltzer. The danger of this pandemic lasting 5 or 10 years is real. University of California, San Francisco Mission Bay nurse and CNA local leader Rosa Villarreal reported that healthcare workers are still fighting for PPE and that she was infected even though she had taken the vaccine. The Delta variant and many other virus variants may cause a future pandemic.
Tackling this new virus is something that CNA has been very active with preparation and asking hospitals to really be prepared for types of pandemics. And we obviously saw that hospitals were not prepared for what was happening. So on many fronts, staffing, what ends up happening is our patients suffer for that. And so then we move into the height of this pandemic and we see things progressively get worse. We ask that hospitals uphold the highest standards and to make sure that we are following aerosolized transmission rules and being extremely precautious because we, at that time, did not know what was going on. And we found nurses were being told to go into rooms without masks, including in COVID units. We had a huge fight of getting our nurses N95s so that they could be protected in these rooms. I mean, we would have people from infectious disease saying, no, go ahead and go in the room, just take this surgical mask and go into the room, it'll be fine. And so it's horrifying to think that we're on the front lines of this and having to have these small battles, which are actually large battles. But this was happening throughout the United States. This was not something that was just at UCSF, it was globally. And so I never worked in a COVID unit, but I have been on the organizing portion of it and the fights and the meetings that we would have with infection control and management and, you know, fighting for testing. That was, you know, a whole nother battle as well, just to have our staff tested and even notified when they were exposed to a virus. We had nurses that would be exposed and then the guidance would be, well, it wasn't really truly an exposure. And so our concerns were often minimized. And then we were asked to go back home to our families, and pretend that we're, you know, safe and that we're not putting them as in jeopardy as well. Luckily, I was able to work with some great nurse leaders who trailblazed these fights, but, you know, this was new territory for us. It was a hard battle and we're still in it. As we've seen, we're now a year later and we're still having issues with exposures. And now those that are vaccinated are becoming infectious. I'm fully vaccinated with the Pfizer vaccine that was, or the end of December. I was within the first week and I came down with the strain. I've been home now for 12 days. And so we're seeing there are vaccinated people who are getting exposed. And so again, this is another outbreak or another surge that we're going to be going through. And we're going to again have to fight for our, make sure we have N95s, make sure that we have the right protections, make sure that we have access to testing. And it's frustrating. It's very frustrating to have to continue to go through these battles. And luckily, we have a very strong unit union who's very adamant about making sure that we're protected and fighting for that. And, you know, when CDC has kind of rescinded the whole masking and, you know, CNA was right there that first minute that that came out, they said, no, this is not a good idea. We still are not to the point where everyone is vaccinated. We should continue to wear masks, even those that are vaccinated. And so we're seeing this again play out. It's a politicized issue that should not be. People's health should not be politicized, and it is. We are in this for the long haul. I tell people that we're in this for at least 5 to 10 years, and that's being conservative, I think. I say that because until people are completely vaccinated, until we have appropriate testing, until we really recognize that this is not going away and that we address this, we're going to be stuck in this. And, you know, when we look at some of these large companies, I mean, including the hospital industry, it's a huge for-profit industry. And so, you know, what we saw was, you know, in the beginning of the pandemic, yes, we did have a slowdown of some surgeries and some procedures. But then, you know, after 2 weeks, we kind of went and started rolling right back. That was without PPE. That was without the proper testing available at our facilities, without the proper staffing. We were expected to continue work as normal. I have pictures of, you know, N95s in my locker that I was having to reuse because I didn't know if I was going to get another N95. I still have conversations with family members who don't understand the fact that I had to reuse an N95 and that even to this day, the availability of an N95 is not always guaranteed to me when I walk into the hospital. So we have, you know, these huge companies. We look at Amazon. Amazon tried to really organize their workers and try to start a union. And look how far and how much money Amazon invested into union busting. So we know that one of the biggest threats to, you know, being able to organize and to be able to support our workers and support, you know, essential workers. And I say essential, you know, because, you know, as society says that we're essential, at the same time, they're not keeping us safe, right? They're expecting us to go out and those low-wage workers who are working at, you know, a fast food industry or someone who's working at a restaurant, they're expected to, you know, just work with these measly wages that no one can live off of anymore. This pandemic has exacerbated these issues in society that we knew was already there. So I'm proud to be in a union. I'm extremely proud of the nurses union.
That was Mission Bay, California nurses leader Rosa Villarroel reporting. The racist terror on the job with hanging nooses and physical attacks continues. In fact, there is a national epidemic of noose hangings throughout the country. I interviewed Black Port of Long Beach Anacostia Belt Railway engineer Lonnie Pate and his lawyer Dan Stormer about the torrent of racial abuse and terror on the job.
Yesterday, we filed in both the state court and the federal court lawsuits on behalf of 7 employees of an entity called Pacific Harbor Line. That is an entity which works out of the Port of Long Beach, along with the Port of Los Angeles. That port is the largest port in the country, the third largest in the world. This particular railroad line gets the product that is being delivered at the port and then delivers it to other railroad lines. It is the heartbeat of the port. Without that line, the product that it gives televisions in Kansas and tables in Iowa would not operate. This company has for years allowed and engaged in exceptionally racist behavior, behavior that cannot be condoned in a civilized society, behavior that is beyond any concept of humanity. And they've done so consistently, and even when faced with numerous complaints and requests for change and attempts at resolving these, they have continued in this. It can only be described as completely racist behavior towards the African-American employees worked there and for any supporters of those employees. Lonnie filed his first EEO complaint in 2010. And he has been attempting to get the issues resolved for almost 11 years now. So the attempt isn't to settle the case. The attempt is to end the racism that exists there, to protect the workers. You've read the complaint, or at least have seen it, and the allegations in there that set forth what my clients have been subject to are just, it's inhumanity at its best.
And Lonnie, why don't you talk about your history at the railroad, what happened to you, and what you faced a long period of time?
I've faced non-promotion, discriminatory names. There's been managers that would write you up for no reason. It's basically anything you could think that was evil that went down there. They did it to you. I started work around 2003, and around 2009, through about in 2010, there was a change in upper management. And when this new management came in is when all things changed for the worse for African-American people and anyone who stood with African-American people, especially those that have what you call targets. They would say, the company would say, if I don't like this guy, he has a target on his back. Any nationality of race was around that guy, associated with him, he would be marked as well.
So this was kind of bullying, organized bullying? Is that what was going on?
Bullying, racism, demotion, discrimination, being called N-word, monkey, slave, baboon, gorilla, coon. I mean, it was like the Jim Crow era of living in America, but it was like it was funneled into the railroad now, and it existed there. It's like the times had never changed for African-American workers there.
And how many African-American workers are there at this railroad line?
Probably 8 to 10 now, out of about 189 employees.
So there used to be more, but they've been driven out?
I want to say it was probably about, I'm guessing, 50 or more, around that many when I started.
Also, the issue of hanging nooses. There's an epidemic of hanging nooses around the country. Have you seen this, or what kind of experience do you have around that issue?
Yes, I've seen it a couple of times. It'll be hanging, like, on the door, because we work in separate areas. The response with management was nothing. I mean, they said nothing. They'd laugh it off sometimes and say, oh, they were just joking around. They was just playing, or they didn't mean any harm. It's time for it to stop, because when it grows to where it's at now, you get it to where it's okay for employees to start doing it. And then they're treating black workers like slaves and stuff like that, leaving their work for you to do, because they know it's okay, because management's telling them now that it's okay, leave it for such and such when they come in, because they're African American. We'll make them do it. So you're doing double shifts and stuff like that.
It is shocking when you start collecting evidence in a case like this and you come up with all the stuff that has been allowed to go on. One of our plaintiffs is not black, but he did support them in the workplace, and he got harassed terribly because of his support for the black employees. So the lesson here was, if you even support them, you will be harassed and punished.
Is there a union at this company?
Yes, there was a union there.
And did you file a complaint with the union? Do they have a non-discrimination clause, the union?
Yes, I did. I did. It went right to management, just as I myself taken it. I've taken complaints to the highest level, the president that's now running the railroad, and he did nothing.
So he was aware of what was happening?
He was aware of what was happening, because when I first filed with the EEOC, he was the mediator at the EEOC mediation. I'd like to say for whoever's listening, that I'm working hard. My attorneys are working hard to make this place a better and a more livable place and more family-oriented place to work. So hopefully it'll be like that for all the people that are listening that wants to get into railroading, because it's a really great job and it's really fun. And if it's ever family-oriented down there, you guys will have a great time. It's a fun thing to do, and you'll love it.
Okay, well, thanks for joining us on Pacifica, and we appreciate your struggle for justice. Thank you for joining us, Lonnie and Dan.
You take care.
Thank you.
That was a report on the racist attacks and systemic racism at the Anacostia Beltline Railway in the port of Long Beach.
They say one nigga, the less, the better the show. Stretch your blaskin' and take your blow. Papa says I stop the Ku Klux Klan. Papa says I stop the Ku Klux Klan. Papa says I stop the Ku Klux Klan. Papa says I stop the Ku Klux Klan.
This is Pacifica's COVID, Race, and Democracy. I'm Steve Zeltzer. The failure of the U.S. capitalist healthcare system to have a public health system is now threatening catastrophe and many more deaths of people in the United States. Public health advocate and Dr. Navin Gordon spoke at a conference on the pandemic and public health care in July.
After the SARS, the original SARS epidemic, Taiwan and Singapore both, what they did is they built up an extensive public health system that involved multiple clinics in every neighborhood, testing sites, and a huge infrastructure of personnel. So Taiwan, for example, when the first virus came out, they had a test within 3 days to test for it, and they massively tested everybody. So massive testing on a regular basis, that anyone coming in was tested. So testing is number one on a mass scale. Number two is isolation of individuals who are positive. They must be quarantined in a very safe location for the correct amount of time. All their contacts must be traced, so you need tracers. So all those people are isolated. And then they need to be supported financially and scientifically. Now, that was done in Taiwan. And so they had, I think, three deaths. And for an entire year plus, they had no masking. Everyone did just like they did, and as if the pandemic didn't exist. China, once the epidemic broke out and they figured out what it was all about, they instituted what they had to at that point. They had to institute a massive shutdown. And what that does is it prevents the transmission, because of a contagious virus is spread through the community, being transmitted from one individual to the other. So if you isolate the entire country and everybody's kept at home, all of a sudden the number of virus particles drops way down. And then you can identify who has it. You can identify their contacts and you can isolate everybody. And in that manner, you can prevent the virus from spreading. And China has done that. I mean, they have 1 billion people and they've managed to keep on top of, you know, the outbreaks that occasionally occur while they are vaccinating people. But that's why you need both. Not only that, you have a vaccine which is never 100%. The original data on the vaccine, that's with the original virus, and now we've had two mutations, at least significant mutations, that are making it much more infectious. That data showed that, yes, 5 out of every 100 would get sick enough to be in the ICU and or die, and 15% would get very sick but not necessarily be hospitalized, and probably another 10% would be infected. So you're talking about a vaccine that cannot prevent totally the spread of the virus. I think the hope of us getting out of the pandemic is really that the working class has to enforce the protection on the jobs and in the schools. And I think teachers are very critical to that, because the shutting down of industry, be it the teaching or being at production on the job, is crucial to reducing the spread of the virus. And demands from the teachers, if they were to go on strike, would not only be related to their school, but should be a much broader social question. They should be demanding, you know, mass daily testing across the country. They should be demanding that the government, instead of giving $1 trillion a year to Wall Street, is giving that to building a public health system. It should be giving the money to people that can't go to work to support them. I mean, all the basic principles of public health, isolation, tracing, testing, and support for those that can't work or who are sick should be part of the demands of the rank and file members who organize on the job. So that would connect them with all the other jobs, you know, around the country, and they would get a lot of community support for that also. It's very clear that most of the capitalist countries around the world are content to allow this virus to continue to spread. And it will continue to spread, and it will continue to mutate. And the vaccines, as the nurse from UCSF said, will become less and less effective. Each new mutation will become able to outwit the immune system that's been boosted by the vaccine. So vaccines alone will never be able to end this pandemic. The only real force to bring true science into controlling this epidemic comes from the working class. The working class was the ones that originally said, we're not going to work, like the teachers. They don't go to work. The meatpackers wouldn't go to work. And that was what really pushed the first lockdown. Now, this epidemic is clearly a crisis of capitalism. I mean, it has been deliberately been allowed to spread in a homicidal criminal policy through the world, basically. What's happened in this country is that we know for a fact that, and in England, it's so clear to see that this is a policy that they started from the beginning of herd immunity, their phony herd immunity, meaning that they will allow this virus to travel through the population. And as Boris Johnson said, let the bodies pile up. I don't care how high, I'm not locking down. And what that means is profits above the people. No question about it. It's just so obvious from the fact that Trump knew about it. China called him, told him. The Security Committee in Congress knew exactly what was happening, told nobody. Congress knew, told nobody. Even the media knew and did nothing about it in December and January and February. And they allowed it, deliberately allowed it to spread. Now, underlying it all is the fact that they, over the last 40 years, have privatized health in the United States to make profit. Healthcare is a profit business. And all they want to do is make money. So what have they done over 40 years? They've destroyed both workers' regulations through OSHA by cutting it back, and public health departments have been decimated over 40 years. Something like $100 billion worth of what we need has been sucked out. So we have no infrastructure to protect the public health. And since they're not about to spend $100 billion, $500 billion on the people, but on the military and Wall Street, there is no infrastructure to massively test, massively isolate, massively contain this pandemic, which could be done, of course. it could be done. If there was a will, we could do just what they did in China. But no, they're not doing that. So their justification is, you know, let it spread. It's their herd immunity. It's the Great Barrington Report. It's Dr. Atlas with let it just spread. And the most recent example, which is so very clear, was that the Delta variant, which was doubling every week to 2 weeks in England for the last several months, the CDC was well aware of it. So the CDC, I call it the Center for Disease Continuation, knew that the Delta virus was going to be everywhere. They knew it was here, and yet they removed all the public health restrictions along with Biden administration at the end of May, the beginning of June, knowing full well that there were 150 million people, that included 40 million children who will not get a vaccine, who will now be exposed as the capitalists pump trillions of dollars into Wall Street and the military. We're just free to die. So it's the criminality of capitalism. And the only solution to this problem is when the working class gets itself organized, frees itself from these corrupt unions, and takes a stand that we are not going to go to work in contaminated environments. We're not going to send our kids in to be contaminated and then bring it back home to us. And that takes an independent working class movement. And that's what I feel we need to build desperately now.
That was Dr. Navin Gordon on the critical need for public health in the United States and what to do beyond vaccines to protect lives.
Oh papa, bon Dieu qui dans ciel là. Est-ce que c'est vrai depuis m'c'est malheureux, m'a périté royaume ciel là. Mon nom sous papa, bon que on va jamais pas de peine à la foi. Tout fausse calamité, quelle fois qu'on me fait me perdre la foi. On compte misère, tout malheureux, petit pas d'un pour pas manger. Depuis l'aime fête, me barrer, après c'est quitter, m'vive en danger. Maintenant, on fait gaz pour ça qui n'a prison sans raison. Ça m'a la fête, l'hôpital qui va cacher une guérison. Voyez, je protège, t'es machin, pistache, prof. Ça soube qui ou elle, on malheureux. C'est sous toi, yo la guerre plus tâche. La prière c'est clé, prière sous table libérée. Oh mon Dieu, quelquefois.
The need for protection on the job is critical for those workers in factories and other workplaces. Cal OSHA safety inspector Charles Rackless reported on the need to protect workers on the job from this sometimes deadly virus.
I cannot speak for Cal OSHA, and I do not speak for engineers union. I was previously an industrial hygienist at California Department of Public Health for 9 years, and for the last 6 years, I've been a safety engineer at Cal OSHA. And for the last year, since last March, I've been doing exclusively COVID response cases. I can't count how many off the top of my head, but I'll tell you, it's been more fatalities and serious illnesses than have come across my desk during the entire 5 years of my tenure prior to the COVID coming on. Professionals in the health field knew of the possibility of a new pandemic. When I was at CDPH, I worked with scientists, toxicologists, biochemists, epidemiologists, and masters of public health. And they were fully aware of the history of the 1918 flu called the Spanish flu. They were responders to the MERS and to Ebola while I was there. And the question in their minds was not if a major situation would get out of hand, become a pandemic, but when it would happen. So there was no question for the idiots who said no one could see this coming. That's just not the case. So when we think about who was in charge during this period, we had President Trump. We may want to forget him, but he was there and he was in charge of the big agencies, and the CDC was under his control. And I would argue that the CDC was politicized. And what do I mean by this in terms of their response? When this first kicked off in December, January, February, everyone understood that it was an airborne transmissible disease. And then they rolled that back and said, no, it's not airborne. We're going to treat it as a droplet disease. But in California, we have a law or a regulation in Title 8, which is what CalOSHA enforces, 5199, the aerosol transmissible disease standard, which if you follow through to the Appendix A, it identifies novel viruses as being airborne until proven otherwise. And what does that mean when we say airborne versus droplet? Droplet would be a mist or something that I spew out in a cough or loud talk. And mostly it's going to fall out of the air within a few feet. But airborne is the actual particles of the virus. And they can float on the air for a long time. People who are familiar with Legionnaires, with tuberculosis, with measles, understand that airborne transmission requires isolation and the use of a higher level of respiratory protection than level one or level two surgical mask. So the viruses are between 50 and 140 nanometers. To catch that, you need an N95 respirator. But as the nurse was saying earlier, they were saying they could use level one, level two masks. And that goes right to the politicization of the CDC and to the complicity of the California Democratic Party, which is the governor is a Democrat, and he has direct control as an executive agency of the CDPH. But the CDPH decided we are going to go along with the CDC. They did not want to challenge and say the CDC was politicized. And the CDPH approved the CDC guidelines. And that is why the big hospitals and skilled nursing facilities and everyone was able to say, thumb their nose basically at Title 8, 5199, and say, we're going with the CDC, WHO, and CDPH guidelines. So CDC is the Center for Disease Control, WHO, World Health Organization, and CDPH, again, being California Department of Public Health. So with this limitation of these masks, we have to understand that these masks were not able to protect the people, and the hospitals basically said, we are going to issue one N95 respirator per day. And if we think how they were supposed to be used, we get our guidance from how our response as medical professionals was to tuberculosis. It was a one use of the N95, and then you throw it out. So because the guidance was put in place, the hospitals limited the access to the respirators. And they made their excuse saying that there were shortages. And why were there shortages? Because the capitalists refused to produce PPE in the United States and refused to stockpile it. They offshored it to a cheaper source of labor in China and used just-in-time logistics instead of stockpiling. So they told us at the beginning of this, we were on a war footing, but it took them months and months to get past the PPE shortage. And they didn't start releasing sufficient PPE until after the CDPH, after the Center for Disease Control changed its guidance when the science was too strong to deny that it is indeed airborne.
That was Charles Rackless reporting on the fight for health and safety on the job. Now from Washington, D.C., Ron Pinchback, host of Community Watch and Comment, along with co-hosts Chip Jones and Don Williams of Pacifica's member station WPFW in the nation's capital, provides commentary and engages listeners about the violent January 6, 2021 insurrection by Trump supporters and the current escalation of COVID throughout the United States, and an analysis of HIPAA, the Health Insurance Portability and Accountability Act of 1996. a federal law of national standards to protect sensitive patient health information from being disclosed without the patient's consent or knowledge.
Let's get started. So Chip, Don, Jerry, you know, raising hell, you know, here we are, mass mandates, you mm-hmm. know, about to happen. Vaccination mandates, you know, already happening. You know, I'm sure people have mixed feelings about that. That's the way of the world right now. So you'd like to share your thoughts about that and raise some hell about that, right. Good, bad, or indifferent.
We have to remember it's not in a vacuum, man. The numbers are not good. You know, we are back up to 94,000 cases per day. We haven't seen this since February. You know, 40% of the new cases are in four states, Florida and along the south. We are headed in a bad direction.
Yeah, and unfortunately, we've got politicians literally playing with people's lives. Now, you know, in Maryland, a new mandate just came out within the past 24 hours. People are going to be required to mask up while indoors. And that's for all public, you know, facilities and such, you know, schools and such. You know, even a debate about, you know, whether kids should be masked or not, you know, right. It's raging and outraging. You know, parents are saying, no, I don't want my kid to be masked, and I don't want no kids to be masked, and this, that, and the other. But once again, the germ doesn't care.
Right. Kids are getting sick. You know,
the germ does not care. It's not Republican. It's not Democrat.
COVID isn't checking IDs. It's going after everybody.
And of course, you know, we also had the news about the attempted coup, but I think a lot of our listeners knew about that a long time ago. Mm-hmm. The Republican coup attempt on January 6th. I mean, they literally had the Justice Department, cronies in the Justice Department ready to take action. We can only imagine it was only because some level people with some fear decided, no, you can't do that. No, stop mm-hmm. that, stop. Otherwise, you know, we may be in Trump land right now. People had the opportunity to go up to Capitol Hill and share, you know, the things that they share with us on air. Right. You know, the things that you know, a lot of common sense, you know, perspectives, you know, it just seems to be missing up there, you know. So the closest we can get is WPFW's airways because we know they listen. OK, so give them something to listen to. All right. Share your perspective on any, you know, any issue that you choose to do. We have a caller. Let's see what the caller is talking about this morning. Good morning and welcome to WPFW.
Morning, Ron, Don, and the Chip Cerruti. How are you guys doing?
Good morning.
Hey.
The last time I spoke with you, I made the comment that what happened on January the 6th was not an insurrection, not a mob action. I'm the one that said it was an attempted coup d'etat. Now here mm-hmm. in the last week, you hear all these news agencies saying the same thing, coup d'etat, soft coup. So all this, all these people that are surrounding Trump, they're all guilty. They're all liars. He needs to be brought to justice. The investigation needs to be done properly. You heard what the police officer said. I'm a retired police lieutenant, 35 years service. D.C. Police Department, other police department, and another police department. Plus, I was in the military. I've been in situations like this. There's no way Ron, Don, and Chip, that the four of us together being cops in a situation like that, there wouldn't have been shots fired. I talked to guys that I used to work with in MPD. Mm. White, black, it didn't matter. Across the board, to a man, they all said the same thing. Had we been there would have been shots fired. They'd have still been cleaning out blood at the doggone Capitol. Had there been black people riding like that, they'd have been shots mm-hmm. fired. But right. I'm sure that they were told, don't use any deadly force.
Right.
We have a caller. Community watching comment.
Yes. First, I'm going to say that you can't believe anything that the pathological liars are saying on the mainstream media. Everything they say is a lie. They're waging a war against the American people. And the first thing I want to say about these people that always asking, they're violating our rights in so many ways. But one of the main ways that they currently violate our rights is they're violating our HIPAA rights. HIPAA is H-I-P-A-A, and it stands for the Health Insurance Probability and Accountability Act. That means that all your health information is private. It's like having a lawyer. The information that you discuss with your lawyer is between you and your lawyer. Your health care information is just between you and your doctor. Nobody has a right to ask you, have you been vaccinated? They're violating your HIPAA rights when they're asking you, have you been vaccinated?
Community watching comment.
Technically not a HIPAA violation to ask for if you're vaccinated. Anyone can do any research, check in with any lawyer, and employers are fully in their legal right to do so. So we have to look at really what's going on here, because it's very easy for people to be susceptible. I work in a lot of vulnerable communities right now. There's a lot of skepticism of the vaccine, and there's a historic precedent, and it's understood. But this vaccine was not developed by the United States government, and this is an international pandemic. So we have to remember that even though the United States was founded on racism, white supremacy, it has a horrible history, we have to understand this is a global issue. This is a human rights issue. We really have to look at human rights right now and understand the equity piece. And yes, it's definitely a lot of communities have been done dirty, and it's a horrible cycle. And I think we all just got to do each other to educate each other. And yes, the media might not always be on point, but guess what? There is, you know, as they say, a broke clock can be right even once a day. So, you know, I support WCFW and alternative sources of media. And I think the best we can do is just continue the same and look for the truth.
Thank you, man.
All right, perfect. Yep.
Thank you.
There we go.
Okay. Raising hell.
Right on time. That's just what I was going to say.
Go ahead, Chip.
I was going to say HIPAA does not stop businesses from asking you if you have a vaccination card. HIPAA allows you to say, I don't want to tell you, but it also allows businesses to say, well, I don't want to let you in. You know, so people are misunderstanding what HIPAA does. You know, it doesn't shield you from certain repercussions. It does say that you can keep your stuff private, and it requires people that are under HIPAA, like your doctor and hospitals, not to divulge that information. But an employer, a business, there are very few people that are not allowed to ask you the question. You are also not forced to answer it, but that does not mean that you are free of any repercussions. I don't have to hire you if you refuse to tell me what your vaccination status is.
Thanks to WPFW's Ron Pinchback, the co-host of Community Watch. Pinchback is a founding member of the Pacifica Task Force and helped to create the name for the show. Find out more about HIPAA and your rights on our website, covidtaskforce.pacifica.org. We also thank editor-producer Akua Holt.
I'm exhausted. Last night I couldn't sleep, but when I did, I could hear bombs in my dreams. Nightmare situation. How could they be so evil? Making mortars out of children and innocent people. We expect the bombs, not knowing where next. Huddle in the corner of my room, trying to protect my little brother as the building shakes like it's possessed. But nothing stronger than the will of the oppressed. I bomb back with my lyrics and rhymes, living the times, trying to break the Palestinian minds. What's hiding in the clouds hanging over my head? My dad risks his life outside to buy bread. The fourth war in my 12th year. At this stage I'm numb, though I haven't feel scared. There's nothing I can do in this case to stay safe. I'm brave, even though this house could be my grave. I want freedom for the population. 2 million prisoners living in this location, shouting at the wall, but nothing is ever changing. That's life under an occupation. I want freedom for the population. 2 million prisoners living in this location, shouting at the wall, but nothing is ever changing. That's life under an occupation. Mothers mourn, fighting with grief. White sheets covered by his death. Lie on the streets, buildings turn to ash, but my mind is made of steel. So it doesn't take much for me to heal. Won't lose the will to live or lose our minds. My auntie lost her home, so she lost her life, but she is still alive, but traumatized by the bombs that flew in and dropped that night. My sister couldn't sleep, tried to stop her cries.
You're listening to Pacifica's COVID Race and Democracy. I'm Steve Zeltzer. Glenn Ford, pioneering black journalist and editor of Black Agenda Report, passed away near the end of July. Paul Jay of TheAnalysis.News did a series of interviews with Glenn about his life story in 2013. Here's a clip from the episode titled, Giving Grassroots Radio Leaders a Voice.
When the next opportunity came up to join James Brown's radio station in Augusta, Georgia, I took it up and I got to the station. It was before dawn on a Monday morning. The general manager of the radio station showed me around. He said, there's your news wire and here's your recording equipment. And then he pointed to a piece of paper on the wall and he said, that's a list of all the big black folks in town. So whenever anything comes across the news wire, you can call some of these big black people and get their comment on it. And I said, I was glad to have the job. So I said, okay, boss. He left the room. I went across the room and look at this piece of paper, and I discovered that it was full of Reverend this and Bishop that. It was a theocracy, and I was disgusted. So I tore the piece of paper from the wall, threw it in the trash can, and for the next week or 10 days, I immersed myself in the real politics, the grassroots politics of Augusta, Georgia. I decided I was going to find out who the real leaders were instead of these accommodationist preachers.
And this is, the civil rights movement is still very much...
Civil rights movement had not arrived in Augusta, Georgia. This is 1970. It also had not arrived in Columbus, Georgia. The civil rights movement did not arrive in many, many, many places. And Dr. King didn't get to go to many, many places because he was shut out of most cities in the South by a phalanx of accommodationist preachers who didn't want any outside agitators any more than the white folks in town who they reported to. And that was the cause of my visceral reaction to the theocratic list that was up on the wall at James Brown's radio station. And that's why I sought out the actual leaders of the community. And the first place I went was to the housing project, because I knew that somewhere in that housing project, there was a large and loud black woman who was actually the leader of the people who lived there. I didn't know what her name was, but I knew she was there. And of course, I found her. And that person became my contact on housing issues. And I also realized that somewhere in Augusta, Georgia, there was a brother who jumped up every time the police beat a black man down. And I found him pretty quickly as well. And he became my go-to person on police community relations. And I knew that somewhere in Augusta, there was a black entrepreneur, a businessman, who was constantly complaining that the city and the county weren't giving any contracts to black folks. And of course, I found him rather quickly, and then into the arena of education and so on. And within 10 days, I had 10 contact people, the actual grassroots leaders of Black Augusta. And those were the names on the wall, the list of the go-to black folks. I informally called them my committee of 10. And so every newscast, every conceivable development would result in a call to one or more of these people.
So the owners of the station react how?
Well, the owner of the station was James Brown, and he was usually gigging somewhere. The preachers didn't like being all of a sudden excluded from the airwaves, but I didn't care. What was most interesting was the growth of these grassroots leaders from folk who were paid attention to on the street, in the still segregated school system, in the housing projects and such, but had never been afforded a microphone, had never been treated as the leaders of their community. And yet, James Brown Station was the only 24-hour black station in town. That meant it had 100% penetration of the community. Everybody listened to it. And these people were on the radio, which meant that, well, they must be the leaders. And they, in fact, quickly grew into the kind of public leaders who could hold forth on their areas of expertise and interest. I watched them blossom and grow. And, no more than 3 or 4 weeks into this experience, as I said, I'd been very unhappy, earning only $70 a week, $52 after taxes, as a news person, not the disc jockey that I had anticipated I would be. But experiencing how the control of this radio microphone allowed me to play a role in changing the political complexion of a rather large black city, that did it for me. I said, well, this is worthwhile work. I'll bear the poverty of it in order to make this kind of social transformation.
And how long before you head to D.C.?
Oh, I went back to Columbus, Georgia, and then to Atlanta, then a period of time at James Brown's radio station here in Baltimore, and then to D.C. by 1972.
And you become, at a pretty young age, you become bureau chief in D.C.
Yeah, after local broadcasting on the what was then the number one radio station in Washington, WOL, I joined the Mutual Black Network. At that time, there were two black-oriented radio networks, the Mutual Black Network and the National Black Network. Both of them had about 80 affiliates. I became the Washington Bureau and also did stints as the Capitol Hill correspondent, the State Department correspondent, you know, for that network.
So at a fairly, I mean, when you're in Georgia and even Baltimore, I would guess, pretty localized politics, localized news, you're now covering national and I would think even foreign policy news.
It's actually the same formula. You don't go by the day book, and you know what that is. It's where at 10 o'clock in the morning, all the events that are sanctioned by the corporate media and the powers that are listed. That really is kind of like that list that I found up on the wall in my first gig. You throw that away. And so either at the local level or at the national level, I made it my business to decide who the spokespersons should be, the experts should be, the analysts should be, and folks who should be recognized as legitimate leaders of the community should be. The formula is the same nationally as it would be locally.
Now, this is mid-70s. Again, a very, very intense period of conflict in the United States and foreign policy abroad. What does this do to the way you look at the world? I mean, you know, you joined the Army as, you know, as you described, you were always kind of political, but joining the Army during the Vietnam War was not something out of the question for you. You chose it. Now you're in Washington covering international, national politics, and you're in the midst of a very controversial period of U.S. history. How does your thinking evolve politically? Well, where are you at?
First of all, one has to understand that there was no such thing as black radio news until there was a black political movement. And that black political movement generated the demand for a different interpretation of reality, generated a demand for media to recognize the leadership that was autonomously bringing forth from black America.
That was pioneering black journalist and Black Agenda Report editor Glenn Ford, who passed away during the last week of July. Last week's Black Agenda Report was a tribute issue, and Paul Jay has republished all five of his interviews with Glenn Ford on his website, theanalysis.news. This past month, Terry Collins, the founder of black community radio station KPOO in San Francisco, passed away. San Francisco poet laureate Tongo Elson Martin read his poem, Capitalists Eat Until the World is Blurry to Them, at the memorial.
These streets have made us saliva. Some people made us saliva too, they usually got on uniforms. While a crazy man spins round and round trying to make a record out of this mass production jungle, maybe I'll join him, count cash and cry. These streets are made of saliva and white sheets are worn by a building in which kids are supposed to learn how to read well. White sheets on the highway too. One down is just one down. But you know, you tell all this to the masses and your teacher will pipeline you. They told me I was jewelry. They told me this is jungle. Well, maybe not jungle, more like 50 machine guns planted in the ground. It's raining faces again in California. What does it say about heaven? What does it say about the people you killed? Waiting lines got so exhausted, a million minds dropped all these faces at once. If the fascists can read the lips of a giant talking in his sleep, we might as well make our demands in prison letters. Today was born the most important trigger finger in the world. Today I've begun counting down the pages between now and a pile of books by a tunnel. Chicago's gonna walk out of Chicago one day. Babies are dragged street signs like old toys today, the most important letter left prison. Babies are laughing flags like faces that have disappeared. Maybe I'll join them. But for now, these streets have made us alive, and we raise half full glasses to the basements that meant nothing in the working poor who live there. We get shot, we get white sheets on California, where the kitchen table likes to talk as much as the walls and romance on the porch consists of hard exotic. I mean, this picture characters talk spit and know that they hard to kill. The kitchen table knows this. The porch is almost convinced that one down is just one down. This town is coming to town. A circus watching itself. Half distracted, half suicidal, thrilled children dressed as cops, thrilled children preaching and policing and intaking and hiring and snatching your money. This town's coming to town with tough trademarks to follow. Today I watch capitalism walk on water and people play dead so that they can be part of a miracle.
That concludes today's edition of COVID Race and Democracy. We thank all of Pacifica's sister stations and its radio affiliates who contribute to the production of the show. Today's show was produced by Steve Zeltzer with help from Ann Garrison, Akua Holt, Cosme Torrey, Paul Jay, and editing by Polina Vasilyev. Music by Steel Pulse, Ku Klux Klan State of Emergency, Densley Pierre Malaire Assassins, and MC Abdul Shouting at the Wall. Our executive producers are Akua Holt, Polina Vasilyev, and Steve Zeltzer. I've been your host, Steve Zeltzer. Thanks for listening. You can find this and all previous episodes at our website, covidtaskforce.pacifica.org.